Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Philip Beverly, Nick Kachagroulis, Khalil Marar, and Chris Roebling. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. Well, a few months ago on this program, around this table, we were talking, and virtually every guest basically confirmed the inevitability, in their opinion, the inevitability of eventual war or military action against Iran. Well, tonight, that looks very unlikely, given some historic negotiations that have been going on secretly for many, many months. An announcement early this morning, that there has been an agreement reached between Iran and the United States that's going to defuse this tension that has existed for the last 30 years. The highlights of that deal are as follows. Iran has agreed to suspend the growth of its Iranian nuclear program and has agreed to frequent testing by international inspectors. The United States is going to ease economic sanctions, about $7 billion worth of economic sanctions. And this is a temporary agreement. It's going to last for 6 months, and everyone is going to see how the other side is reacting. Khalil Marar joins us. He is with Governor State University. Your reaction to this historic document, and I guess the most important question is, can we trust Iran?
Yes, we can. And the reason we can is because it is in Iran's self-interest to do this exact deal. Look, you know, I've been saying for years now that Iran wants three things. The first thing is that it wants to have accessible technology to develop energy in some way, shape, or form. The second thing it wants to have is that it wants to be free from any possibility of an attack, whether Israeli or American. And the third thing that it wants is that it wants to be included in the community of nations. This has been the Iranian platform since the 1970s, and they have softened quite a bit since the Islamic Revolution.
Kachagroulis also joins us. Forgive me for screwing up your name. From DePaul University, Nick, your reaction to this document.
I think it's good as well. I think it's a positive step in the right direction, a big win for the Obama administration in moving forward. And I think that there's, like any deal, there's things to look at positive and negatively, but a step in the right direction in this area is a big step.
Chris Roebling is our card-carrying Republican tonight. Chris, you have a frown on your face. You're not as enthusiastic as our professors are.
No, this is a spectacular disaster, and I don't think there's any basis upon which to have any real hope for a better Iran. Iran has gotten out of this time. It's gotten money. It's gotten an ability to continue its research and weaponization. With its ballistic missile system, which has nothing to do with energy, to my friend Khalil's point. And it's really gotten an opportunity to change the momentum. I mean, it has marshaled international public opinion by getting the very tired and worn out Germans, Brits, French, Russians, Chinese, and Americans to go along with this. And I think it's going to be disastrous, and I know we'll have time to make more points.
Why, Khalil, in your view, why is France so opposed to this deal?
France fears a nuclear Iran. The United States fears a nuclear Iran. It's just that the French feel much closer to a nuclear neighborhood. And the truth is, Bruce, the French have basically taken a much more hardline stance in recent events. So, for example, you look at the French in Mali. You look at the French in Syria, for example. You look at the French across the world. They have been much more hawkish, ironically, than where the United States is. And for the simple reason that the French can actually act in a way that does not upset public opinion as it does in the United States of America. We are war-weary. And my friend, Mr. Roebling, says that, you know, we have a tired British and German and French and otherwise. But frankly, the United States of America is tired of being in decades of war now.
Well, Chris, you agree with that?
Nobody wants to be in war, but it is the aggression, really, of the Iranians daily throughout Gaza, throughout the West Bank, throughout Beirut and Lebanon and Syria. You know, they operate, they are a terrorist state. And what the Obama administration has essentially said in this agreement is they will be a nuclear-armed terrorist state, and that's not good for anybody. And the reason the French understand this is because they have such intimacy with that part of the world.
Look, I'm not a fan of the Iranians. You know, you can call them any name you want to. No skin off my back. All I care about is that we have a neighborhood in the Middle East that no longer involves the kind of militant warpath that we have been on, frankly. And I don't think that anybody wants to see another Middle East war. That would be a catastrophe.
What does this do? Because obviously the chief critic of this plan, there have been leading members of the Senate that have opposed the plan, including John McCain. However, Israel, Netanyahu, vehemently said this is not something to rejoice about. This is a bad idea. So does this embolden Israel? And will it perhaps force Israel at some point, independent of the United States, to take some military action? Because it's in their defense, that their defense is more important to them than it is to us.
Well, obviously Israel is not going to be happy with this. They're right next door, so to speak, a lot closer than even France is. And so any nation in that particular area that would have nuclear capability, they would not be in agreement with. But I think that this agreement allows certain things like checks and balances to be able to be there that weren't allowed before. Such as the ability to go in and I think it's actually even on a weekly basis, and I may be wrong on that, to
daily,
be able to
daily basis.
Check on that, which we did not have the access
that,
to. Right,
are you pleased with that? I mean, isn't that a significant
something like that? Is,
and again,
is good.
Who can do that?
The International Atomic Energy Administration, IAEA,
which is a variety of
right.
countries.
It's a multilateral.
Not just the United States.
Those are the subject matter experts in this area.
So you're comfortable with the frequency of those inspections, mm-hmm. and basically the makeup of those that will do it, at least at this moment.
Yeah. Okay. But it just doesn't go far enough. It doesn't go far enough.
But there's a six-month check on it.
That's
and
right.
And that's the thing that I think is this region is going to grow, and Iran knows they need to grow economically, and that's what they're seeing. There's the energy piece, but there's also the economic piece, and I think that that's huge because if we're going to actually engage in a diplomatic relations in this area, that's what's going to do it.
Is this a big win for Putin?
Yes.
No.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
No,
why do you think it is?
Because Putin and the Chinese, the Russians and the Chinese had blocked any serious efforts prior to this. And they did this because they are in commercial relationships with Tehran, and they are selling them reactors and nuclear-related materials. And they were opposed to shutting down the nuclear development programs. And this agreement does not shut down the nuclear development program. In fact, the language, and I wrote this down so that I'd have it, quote, the final agreement, this is an agreement to try to get to another agreement in 6 months, involve a mutually defined enrichment program. If it is true, and Kerry is now arguing with the Iranians over this, if it is true we've conceded the right for them to weaponize uranium, then we've got a nuclear Iran on our hands.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8229, wherever you're listening from coast to coast, border to border, your reaction to the Iranian nuclear deal, actually. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We're talking about the big Iranian deal. And again, I want to get back to sort of the differences as to how Republicans and Democrats might play this. Is there any part of this, Chris, that the president should get credit for?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is an element of conversation. There's an element of multilateralism. There's an element of sort of seeking a public international legal framework or quasi-legal framework for the resolution of some of these issues. And I think that that's all very worthwhile in general. But the reality, I think, about this administration, especially in the Middle East, is the lack of any sort of second act. And I think that what we see here, if I may, just to give an example, the first act was the speech in Cairo at the university. And the first act essentially, I believe, could be referred to as sort of an apology tour, a resetting of our relationships. We know that we got out. This is Obama talking. We've gone beyond the rails with things like Iraq, and so now we're going to be there are different folks in charge. I'm sorry. Act two then became we're not going to lead in Libya, or we're going to let Mubarak go down in Egypt. That sort of. Now we've gotten to really the most important part, which is Act 3. And I don't think there's a strategy. I don't think there is a strategy for this administration in that region that reconciles our two closest friends since we abandoned Egypt. And those close friends are the Saudis, the House of Saud and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and the Israelis.
Why does he, because for a while, I mean, earlier this year, I mean, he was out there banging the drums for possible military action. He was very close to calling for military action.
President Obama.
And based on at least the reports that we have now, while he was doing that, some of these secret negotiations were going on.
So one would expect that they were related.
Well,
he was attempting to give cover to positions being taken in the private conversations.
Right. And then you have the story that his chief of staff at the time, they went out for a walk and they came back and suddenly, you know, John Kerry, who had been put way out front, speaking in very militaristic terms, suddenly he looks like he's left out to dry.
Yes. Freelancing.
I mean, how much of what we have been observing, the conduct of the president, the conduct of the Secretary of State, how much of it has been a charade?
It's called diplomacy.
Over the last several months. Well, go ahead.
Yeah, it's called it's called diplomacy. I mean, look, unless
which is saying one thing and doing another.
No,
I call that hypocrisy.
No. It's diplomacy to the nth degree. I mean, this is a. I don't want to go too far and say it's a great move or anything like that. I'm very suspicious. The deal is suspect. Let's just put it that way. And until we actually verify that the Iranians are actually doing what they're saying they're going to do through those inspections, we can't have any faith in it whatsoever.
And what if they do? What if they don't? Based on what you know now, what happens if they don't do it?
Then
six months down the road.
Then God help us all, because it means war in the Middle East. That's precisely what this administration.
But before war, Khalil,
there'll be another 5 years of discussion.
Will take us to
before war.
Let me finish the point.
Let me finish the point.
The point is this. The point is this is a deal that basically allows all parties to take some breathing room. It is not an act of tragedy. It is not an act of apology. It's simply this administration trying to exhaust the last means before a military strike against Iran. The Iranians know this. The Israelis know this. We know this. The Obama administration knows this.
Another big winner is Rouhani, right? Don't you think he's
okay,
a big
winner? Okay, so let's go back.
He campaigned by basically saying he wanted to reduce the sanctions.
Let's go back.
So isn't he a big, again, looking at domestic politics, Ian, isn't he a big, big winner? Nick.
I'm going to go back to a different point. I want to comment on the administration saying one thing and then going and making this deal. I think that happens all the time in politics, and that's the nature of the game. We saw that totally when we deal with congressional politics.
Absolutely.
We take a
but
hard
Obama
line.
Went very far down the road.
Well, you do. You go.
I mean,
he did
for a left of center president. He was shaking those rattles.
He was.
But obviously something
Sabers,
moved.
Rather, not
something
rattles.
Moved. And Sabers. When you're in a negotiating table, you don't put those negotiations public. We will probably not know exactly what moved, but a domino moved there. And I think it's the president's advantage or to the president's best ability to take advantage of that to not push us into a military situation if he doesn't have to. Now, may ultimately lead that way if Iran does not agree, but it's a step.
Look, we are now measuring the so-called breakout period in months. Okay. And as recent it has been said to be now down to months, okay, by officials, okay? So you might disagree with those officials, that's fine.
Far right-wing websites.
No, not far right-wing websites. I mean, this we are talking about Netanyahu, who is the head of government of Israel. But what we are talking about now is a situation in which we have formally adopted an expectation that they will get a bomb. Okay, we are formally adopting an expectation that they will get a nuclear bomb.
I don't agree with that.
Here is the difference. If they have every element for a nuclear bomb, then there is a period in which they can assemble those elements. That is absolutely the case. That is a place that this administration has been prepared to go. That is the place where Netanyahu and even Democrats in the House and Democrats in the Senate today said they did not want Iran to go. Now, the Iranian people are a great people. They've been around for 3,000-4,000 years. We've got a lot to learn from the Iranian people. They're great people. The Iranian government, on the other hand, has to be understood in context of their last 40 years of activity.
But I think there's two points here that we have to take. First of all, we are giving them some leeway to do some research on energy and new nuclear weapons. But two, first of all, there's been a change in administration that has happened in the last.
From
they're asking for a chance. And this Iran is getting a chance. They said they want to work together. We're giving them a chance.
What chance have they given the moderate forces in Syria that they are attempting to decimate daily? What chance do they give the settlers? What chance have they given any of their adversaries anywhere? I mean, these are trained killers and terrorist supporters. And the idea that we take a public, legal, international step that enables them to increase their research on weaponization, to increase their research on ballistic missiles, to increase all of their research on they're not destroying
here's the thing. If we're going to use that kind of language, like terrorist state and violent state and all those
that
things,
has been the policy of the United States for years.
Can you please let me finish? We have to back it up with action. And until our Republican friends in the Congress and the country can do that, we have to be very cautious. We have to proceed with pause. We have to be very careful. If Iran is indeed the kind of vindictive, dictatorial, terrorist, nuclear state, then action would have been taken and must be taken by those that are calling it that. In lieu of that, unless they're willing to take us down that path to my humble opinion, which would be the path to perdition, the path to hell, then we have to be very careful and allow the diplomatic route to work. No. Right now, we have a diplomatic solution that is verifiable and one that actually gives both sides some breathing room.
You were shaking your head when you said verifiable.
No, solution. This is an interim step. This is not a solution. This is an interim step.
But at the core of this, at least the I want to go back to the the frequency of the inspections,
right?
And the neutrality or the objectivity of those
of the inspectors.
It's only as good as the inspector.
Hallelujah.
So far, you think it's okay. Doesn't that speak to Reagan's foreign policy motto?
Trust but verify.
Trust but verify.
Well, I would say yes, it does. Although here I think distrust and verify. But here is the point. Here is that if this 6-month interim step had been arrived at because of Obama foreign policy initiative, say in year 2 of his presidency, okay, 3 years ago, I think we all could have felt very differently about this. Right now, what has brought Iran to the table, quite obviously, is its desire to benefit from the more than $7 billion that will be freed up from the sanction regime.
Yes.
Okay? And so The sanctions have been working. The sanctions are very sophisticated now. And they still have $100 billion that they cannot access, and this is not changing that, so that's a good point. But we are much later in the game in year 5 of President Obama's presidency than we were in year 2 or 3. And therefore, my orientation, and I think people who think like I do, would have been to increase the sanctions and decrease the ability of Iran to get to the weaponization on its own.
Well, Republicans seem to suggest that they still want to go down the road of increasing sanctions.
And
look,
Democrats.
I think we've made a win in the sense that I agree with Khalil on this one, in the sense that this is a step in the right direction. We can actually go in and be able to look at things and see if there's any movement in the wrong direction that, you know, we can take action on it. And secondly, I agree that the fact that if the intelligence had been there and Obama had, as you said, pointed out, Bruce, Obama had went out that far, I think action would have followed. So there's something here to look at.
By Israel, too, by the way. I mean, yeah. Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, cannot hold up this caricature bomb at the United Nations and say this is where Iran is heading and not take action. The first people that would have taken action are the Israelis, with, by the way, with Saudi support. The only people that are more afraid than Israel of a nuclear
Saudis.
Iran is Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia does not have any nuclear deterrent. Israel does.
We got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. Your reaction to the Iranian deal? Big, big deal. Your reaction. 1-800-723-8029. Taking America's political pulse from coast to coast every Sunday night. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8289 is the phone number. We're talking this evening about the historic deal that was hatched between the United States, or negotiated, I guess. Hatched is another word. between Iran and the United States, announced today by the Secretary of State and the President of the United States. And, of course, there's been a reaction from all over the world. In just a few moments, we'll hear what Secretary of State John Kerry had to say about the deal. He was on a number of the shows this morning. But let us introduce our guests, and let us begin with Khalil Marar.
Thank you, Bruce. My name is Khalil Marar. I'm a professor at Governor State University. I'm the author of a previous book called The Arab Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, a forthcoming book called Middle East Conflicts, The Basics. I'm happy to be on the show with your guests and yourself tonight.
Also is Nick Kacharubis.
Yes, Nick Kacharubis. I'm a visiting assistant professor in the School of Public Service at DePaul University. Just finished my PhD in leadership and did a study looking at the President of the United States and his relationship with the Chief and Deputy Chief of Staff.
And Chris Roebling.
Good evening. My name is Chris Roebling, and it's a real privilege to be on Beyond the Beltway. I've done a lot of Republican commentary over the years, and go back some time with the program with Bruce, and also involvement on right-of-center activities.
And also joining us is Philip Beverly, who's been very quiet in the first half hour of the podcast because he just got here, got stuck in traffic, but he's here. Philip Beverly, introduce yourself, and then we'll get your opinions.
Thank you, Bruce. I'm an associate professor of political science at Chicago State University. Been there for a bit over 20 years. Following on the radio this time.
Now,
glad to be here.
You have been following the early part of our discussion, and also, so I want to ask you the question that I ask all the others. Your reaction to the significance of this, how significant is it? And most importantly, do you believe we can trust the Iranians?
I appreciated your Reagan reference. It was probably the only thing that I agreed with with Ronald Reagan in 8 years of his presidency. Trust but verify. We don't have, I believe, a solid enough relationship with the Iranians to trust that this puts us on the road to something permanent. And that it is 6 months is very hopeful. We try it out. We find out what works and what doesn't work, and see if they're amenable to continue relationship building, because that's what I think this is.
Does this, because what we know is we know that Israel, we know that Saudi Arabia, and we know that France, three allies of the United States, don't like this deal. What does it do to our reputation and the president's reputation with those three leaders and those three countries?
Given that the reasons for them not liking it are all different between them, I think France doesn't like it for their own sort of economic reasons. They've been trading partners with Iran for a long time. The Saudis have the Shia sort of fear or paranoia, given that they're Sunni and they've got more of a religious thing, I think, happening. And the Israelis obviously aren't going to like anything but complete disarmament on the part of the Iranians. So I wouldn't expect anything.
Let's
from
be
the
careful
Netanyahu
about
government.
The Shiite versus Sunni thing. The truth is, these are two states that are involved. Anytime that a state gets nuclear weapons, another state naturally feels fearful. You could have a Catholic Saudi Arabia that would still be afraid of a nuclear Iran. You could have a Shiite Saudi Arabia that would still be afraid of a nuclear Iran, in much the same way that Syria or Egypt or Morocco is afraid of a nuclear Iran. These are states we're talking about. They're not fiefdoms. Although Saudi Arabia, you begin to wonder whether they're a fiefdom or not.
How does this historic agreement, How is it being reviewed and played, in your view, Chris, in North Korea?
Well, I think
what lessons are they learning?
They're opening the champagne bottles in Pyongyang because they are seeing once again that the United States is very easily separated from its obvious geopolitical interests. And I think that North Korea looks very closely for signs of weakness. And I think there is no way in a realpolitik way to view this as anything other than at the very best, you have to view this as an attempt for the United States to pressure Israel into accepting a nuclear-armed Iran with a new guarantee from the United States for the defense of Israel. And I believe, just so that I may finish my point, I believe that the points that Khalil has been making recently are all very valid, and I think that they all point to the potential of proliferation, and that is yet another detriment of this situation. If we had had a hard line, I'm all for this agreement 3 or 4 years ago. We could have tested it out. We could have seen it. We didn't do that for whatever reason. I'm not even assigning blame. I'm not going to attack the president. We didn't get there. Now we ought to be wringing these guys away from their nuclear weapons, because if we allow a nuclear-armed Iran, there will be a proliferation race in that region unlike anything we've ever seen before.
Sure. Khalil. I'll tell you why we haven't tried it 3 or 4 years ago or 6 years ago. It's interesting that the previous administration is not being mentioned here. When you call a state an axis of evil or part of an axis of evil, there's really like a lot of tension that is created as a result of such a proclamation. The reason that Iran was persona non grata and really developing this nuclear program, that they are, that's conceded fully, is because Iran was basically left out to dry by the previous administration and was called all of these names that our neocon friends called it. Now that we have an administration that did do the Cairo speech, now that we have some sort of rapprochement, I hate to use that word, but that's exactly what we have going on. Now that we have a cooling of the temperature a bit, we have a pause for diplomacy to work for the first time, not in only 8 years or 10 years or 12 years, for the first time since 1979, for the first time since the Islamic Republic came into being. The question that we should ask ourselves, Bruce, is this. Is it in the strategic interests of the United States of America to go to war in the Middle East for a third time in as many decades? And if the answer is no, then we really shouldn't be talking about war at all.
Yeah. I'm not talking about war.
Seeing as we're talking about an agreement here, it really does take two to come to that agreement. And I don't believe that Iran, for some of the reasons that you mentioned, was prepared to come to that agreement. So 2 years ago, it wasn't going to be possible.
Right.
So that's just the way it is. That we have something now in this relationship-building process, that's the important step that we take. And then we are very measured in how we proceed.
Very brief. Now the time for attempting to assess the honesty or the integrity or the intentions of the Iranians, in my opinion, at this point, as close as we are to their weaponization and ability to deliver, that time has passed. Now we should be upping the sanctions to create a boundary between them and a nuclear weapon.
One of the things that's happened in the last several months is obviously the change in leadership of Rouhani, the president of Iran. I think we all know that the real power in Iran is still Ayatollah Khomeini. Okay, yes. So the question, my question is, Rouhani said that when he ran for president, he said he wanted to work on the sanctions and reduce the sanctions.
Chief negotiator, by the way.
So he has a big plus in the political speeches that he made to get him to where he is.
That's right.
His charm offensive, which was described that way by Netanyahu when he came to the United States, and I even made the point on this program, it was one of the best presentations of an alleged enemy of the United States on American television, and he did it over and over again, and then he started to tweet and Facebook and everything else. So he is a different face than the Ayatollah Khomeini.
Exactly.
But the reality is, the Ayatollah could wake up tomorrow and say, I don't want to. I'm not going to abide by this deal.
Let me tell you a little.
And then Nick, I want to get your reaction. Then what happens?
Right.
Well, and I think that's the point. Is there are daily.
In other words, Rouhani may. I mean, he may have his chain pulled like John Kerry had his chain pulled by his boss.
Well, and that can change our reaction immediately at that point. But I do want to agree with something Chris made in the sense that that this deal does actually open – it sets a precedence for other deals. And Bruce, you made this point as well, is it's hard for us. I think North Korea is excited about this because they see a window of opportunity here. There may be a way to negotiate. Other nations may be saying that as well. So it may be a different model, but – if you were in those nations, you would look at that and say, ooh, there's some room here to negotiate with the United States.
So the leaders of Korea, South Korea, should be every bit as worried as Saudi Arabia.
Absolutely.
No. North Korea is a different model. North Korea actually has nuclear weapons.
True.
Iran does not. Different model. There's Absolutely. A different model there. But that's besides the point.
Is there anything in this agreement that prohibits North Korea from providing information to Iran?
No.
North Korea will do what North Korea is going to do no matter what in the status quo.
So isn't that doesn't that worry you?
Of course it does.
North Korea
of course it does.
You know, they could read this document entirely different.
That's precisely why we need to include Iran in the community of nations so that it does not
deal with countries rogues like North Korea. Iran is not North Korea. Iran wants to be included in the community of nations. North Korea does not. Iran is not a dictatorial, totalitarian, communist state.
No, it's an authoritarian.
North Korea is.
It is a dictatorial. It's a dictatorial.
Republic that wants to be included.
It is a dictatorial, theocratic, authoritarian state. And I think there is no difference between Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and Rouhani, the new president. There really is no difference.
Good.
Why? Because of the point that Bruce made. Ayatollah Khamenei maintains supreme power, and he can wake up tomorrow and change things. And you know, Khalil a few minutes ago said, oh, well, this is obviously about weapons, and the Iranians have said that. Let me tell you, we've been through 10 years of the Iranians denying it was about weaponization. They have denied it was about weaponization, and they have said, no, we who are sitting on more petrochemicals than anybody in the entire world are trying to exploit nuclear energy.
Got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We're talking about the historic deal between the United States and Iran. And again, this morning, Secretary of State John Kerry was on many of the programs, including this week with George Stephanopoulos. And this was his initial response and explanation of this historic deal that was announced today. Secretary of State John Kerry.
Vision is not the art of fantasy or the art of the ideal. It's the art of the possible, which is verifiable and clear in its capacity to be able to make Israel and the region safer. The fact is that Iran's ability to break out, George, will expand under this program. Therefore, Israel will be safer, the region will be safer. Iran's 20% uranium will be destroyed. Therefore, they are safer. Iran's 3.5% uranium stock will be frozen at its current level, and the centrifuges will not be able to be installed in places that could otherwise be installed and advance the program.
But not dismantled.
The fact is we will have daily inspections. We will have daily inspections. No, that's not. That's correct. That's the next step. Now, the choice people have is, do you want to sit there and argue that you have to dismantle your program before you've stopped it? And while you're arguing about dismantling it, they progress. In 2003, Iran made an offer to the Bush administration that they would, in fact, do major things with respect to their program. They had 164 centrifuges. Nothing has happened. Therefore, here we are in 2013. They have 19,000 centrifuges, and they're closer to a weapon. You cannot sit there and pretend that you're just going to get the thing you want while they continue to move towards the program that they've been chasing. we've actually succeeded through the sanctions that Congress put in place to be able to get to a point where we're locking in knowledgeably what their current level is and forcing them to go backwards. And while we go through these next 6 months, we will be negotiating the dismantling. We will be negotiating the limitations. But you can't always start where you want to wind up. And most people I've talked to who've looked at this carefully say the alternative that they're proposing just doesn't work.
There also seems to be a clear difference between the United States and Iran and the
Chris issue. Roebling, your any different reaction than you did at the beginning of the program?
No, I mean, I saw that, and I think that Secretary Kerry was told by the president to get a deal, and this is obviously in the works since March. I mean, the Associated Press reported this this morning or this afternoon that there had been, you know, non-public meetings between officials of the two governments starting in March and continuing through the fall. In other words, on both sides of their Iranian presidential so-called election. And so it is, and we all knew that there was a shoe waiting to drop when we went through this sort of public drama about will the president see the head of state of Iran at the United Nations, and will they talk on the phone? So we all knew something was going on. Okay. So Secretary Kerry is laying out some very important points there, and I think that those points represent, to me, the absence of American leadership. The American leadership position would have been to say, you've had opportunities to stop. We are increasing the sanctions. When you are serious, when you stop lying about the program to the entire world community, we are ready to receive you.
I want to bring a call into the conversation. Scott, listening to us on the internet in Cincinnati. Go ahead, Cincinnati. You're on the air. Scott, are you there? Scott is not there. Go ahead. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, we can now. Speak up.
Oh, okay. Well, you know what? I'm a young man, guys. I'm 22, and I'm really engaged in all this. And you know what? In my honest opinion, I think it's absurd that Iran isn't allowed to have one nuclear weapon. Let's look at the facts here. Israel supposedly has over 200 nuclear weapons. They're terrorizing Palestinians with them on a daily basis, yet we don't hear not one word of this because of the Zionist Western media. Come on, guys. Why are we making a boogeyman out of Iraq? It's a phony war on terror. The Rothschild bankers are playing the United States.
No,
and there's not much more to it than that.
Khalil, cut it. Khalil, go ahead. Thank you very much, Scott, for your call for wherever it's from.
Okay, you know, we always have. Yeah, I'm not going to dignify that with a response. You're right. Thank you.
Let us now look ahead 6 months from now.
Yeah.
What do you think, Nick, what's going to happen in 6 months? How will we know whether this deal is working or not?
Well, we'll know whether there's been progress made in as far as the inspections daily, and if the amount of centrifuges has gone down, and the percentages that Secretary Kerry outlined have been met. If they haven't, then it hasn't worked.
And what's going to happen on the day after that? The day after the deadline.
Well, that's a good question.
Because there will be a lot of press. Everyone's going to look at their clock, and it's going to be on everybody's news watch. They're all going to be looking 6 months. Okay, 6 months and a week, Chris. What do you think they're really doing? They're letting all the inspectors in. They're giving up what they have to give up, and you still don't believe that somewhere in the back room, somewhere in the middle of the country, there isn't somebody working to weaponize.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think that we have the slightest idea of all of the locations in Iran. I think that there are a lot of problems with this regime. And I'm not, discrediting what Secretary Kerry tried to do. I think in 6 months we're going to see that Iran is still attempting to move without any interference to a nuclear weapon.
That's not true.
And I think they are going to move to a nuclear weapon, and we are going to be trying to tell the Saudis and the Israelis,
not true,
life is possible with a nuclear-armed Iran.
But that could still happen even without
this
deal.
In the status quo, it's happening right now. It's happening right now without the deal, and it's been happening exactly as Secretary Kerry said.
On that note, we want to thank Khalil Morar and Philip Beverly and Nick Katsouroulis and Chris Roebling for being with us in hour number one. They will all be back in hour number two. We're going to be switching gears and talking about some new topics. But again, if you're listening on radio, 1-800-723-8289. Keep the calls coming. And if you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Tonight featuring commentary by Philip Beverly of Chicago State University, Nick Kacharubas of DePaul University, Khalil Morar of Governor State University, and Chris Roebling of Jane C. Thompson & Associates in Chicago. Our phone lines open at 1-800-723-8289, coming to you from the Museum of Broadcast Communications in downtown Chicago. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, beyondthebeltway.com. And also, we're going to get each of our guests to share with us some pet topics that are near and dear to their heart, and we're going to start in just a moment. But I do want to go around the table once, because last week we spent the entire second hour talking about the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And those within the sound of my voice have now been able to sit through a week of media coverage of that event, both on radio and television and print. Wherever you turned, there was something related to the Kennedy assassination. We did a major thing here at the museum where we played all of NBC's coverage for 6.5 hours last week, and we had a good turnout for that. And I want to get everyone's reaction. Chris Roebling, I'll start with you. Too much coverage? Too much? Are those who were alive at the time, who were in positions of power at news organizations, are they overstating the importance of what happened on November 22nd, 1963?
No, I don't think that they are. I think that President Kennedy is one of only two people in human history who can be identified as having saved a quarter of a billion lives. And I think that for that reason, even though his presidency was cut short and he had a middling record in his relations with Congress, I think you have to put him right under the tier of greatest presidents. But globally, he's one of the greatest leaders ever, because he avoided war. This is what Khalil was talking about in the last hour. And so I don't think that the circumstances of his passing, given the mysteries, okay, that continue to propagate, should be overlooked.
By the way, those mysteries today, as the day that Lee Harvey Oswald was murdered or shot, today is the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination conspiracies.
That's exactly right. And I think that, not to get into the conspiracies, but the moment of the assassination of a United States president, and indeed that United States president, should be recalled, especially in view of what President Kennedy had accomplished.
Philip Beverly, same question to you.
Ooh.
Too much?
No, I don't think so. There's only been 43 other presidents. So they are almost a very elite club. And when one of them is assassinated, that's something that I think we need to always historically pay attention to, for what it represents and what it, ironically, how well it represents the strength of our democracy, that we have peaceful transition to the next.
But did a lot happen? Did the world change dramatically? Had John Kennedy lived, how would American history be different?
You know, I had my students ask me that, because they think I was around since the Big Bang or some ridiculous thing. And I think he would have probably suffered the same fate that Johnson suffered because of Vietnam. Mm-hmm. We were going to do the Vietnam War, and we were going to have likely the same outcome. And I think he would have been equally tainted by it. I think the hope that he brought to the country, and I think to the world, was inspiring. And to have that cut short, that idealism just sort of swept away, yeah, we changed.
Nick Kacharubas.
I think it wasn't overdone. I think it was good for it to be done. And I'm going to come at it from a different perspective. As a student of history and a history major in undergraduate, I think it it was an important event. And I know as a kid I was just fascinated about it. But I think it also passes on the importance to the next generation. Because it was so involved in the social media, online, I think that the importance of that, we always hear about Lincoln, and nobody seems to talk about that being too much. I think this kind of passes that on to this next generation as an important moment in our history as a nation.
Khalil Morar.
Ich bin ein Berliner. I mean, this really is a president that represented the voice of a hopeful generation that really turned very sour as the 60s wore on. And I think that, no, I don't think that I agree with everything that's been said. I can't add anything more to what's been
said.
How
much of what happened in the 1960s after his death happened because of that death? And as you say, his the fact that the man who followed in his wake, the president Lyndon Johnson, knew how to work Congress, and also the American people were willingly sympathetic to a new president, at least for the first few years. Could any of that happen without? I mean, Johnson followed through on everything that Kennedy wanted to do and wasn't able to do, certainly in the area of civil rights and war on poverty and a lot of other things.
Absolutely. As a student of presidential leadership, Johnson passed more legislation than any other president in history, and he did it in 1964, the year after Kennedy was shot. And I think it was because he knew how to work Congress. There were great initiatives in there, some debatable whether how great, but he was able to work Congress, get things passed, and the mood of the nation played a lot into that, and I don't think he would have been as successful in passing that legislation had the assassination
occurred. Was the mood similar? I think we can compare the mood similar to post 9/11. It was pretty difficult for a long period of time to criticize the president of the United States, ask questions.
That is absolutely right.
There was this
right.
national sympathy, and just as Lyndon Johnson knew what to do with that from a congressional standpoint, so did George W. Bush.
Yeah, notwithstanding his overwhelming ambition to achieve the presidency himself, and notwithstanding the fact that a few people, even shortly after the assassination, raised the question, look who benefits here, was Johnson somehow involved? In general, I think that Johnson received an enormous grant of grace for his activities. And it's true, Johnson had a much more effective relationship with Congress. So I think that the nation went through a period, there was a seizing up of the nation in the immediate aftermath of the assassination that brought everybody together.
Do you believe,
as Vietnam played out, that gave people grounds, just another war, okay? The Vietnam played out, and that gave people, especially the liberals, an opportunity to come back and to start criticizing Johnson.
But do you believe what Nick just said, that Kennedy probably would have been trapped by those same... The same geopolitical
that
trapped Johnson.
My understanding, I've seen some of it, but my understanding of the documentary evidence indicates that, and I'll give you a basis. I believe that the assassination, the November assassination we never talk about, was President Diem in Vietnam. And that was a Kennedy administration policy that got hatched in August of 1963, and it probably should not have happened. There are a lot of terrible things going on there. I believe that Kennedy's willingness to allow the Diem assassination to proceed, which is exactly what it was, indicates that he was going down the same road. And there are people who want to say, oh no, he was going to be this great liberal and he was going to oppose it. That's not indicated by the documents.
And he was not a great liberal in foreign policy. He was
And he was killed by a communist. He was not killed by a right-wing extremist. He was killed by a committed Marxist-Leninist.
Yeah.
We have got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. If you want to react to that, 1-800-723-8029. And when we come back, we're going to go into several other different directions. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's head to calls. Youngstown, Ohio. Let's hear WKBN. Tom, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, first of all, happy Thanksgiving to you and your guests. Bruce.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
You know, as far as the Kennedy assassination is concerned, for those who think that in a conspiracy being called a kook, I'm reminded of Martha Mitchell during Watergate, who was also called a kook by saying that it wasn't just a third-rate burglary.
Right.
And I guess what I'm wondering is, would you and your guests agree that the at least 1,000 pages or 1,000 documents that CIA has, let alone the other documents that are either sealed or partially redacted, should be released in their full, because if there was no conspiracy, then 50 years after the fact, There's no security reason for keeping that information, and there's no reason in terms of sensitivity to the Kennedys, because we already know about the sexual escapades. The Zapruder film's been released. The autopsy photos have been released. I guess what I'm saying is there's no real reason to have anything sealed into 75 years as what was originally intended, other than there's something to hide.
I totally agree. First of all, it was 87 years of sealing, so we've got 37 more years to wait. I agree with you. I don't think there's any reason to wait. It just adds to the mistrust that people have in their government. I think the beginning of the mistrust of between in government goes back to the Warren Commission. I said that last week on the program, the Warren Report. And there's no reason for it not to be released at the moment, but don't think it's going to be released. And the other thing that's important, because I think it has to be put into context, the House Assassinations Committee looked into this subject for over 3 years. They came to the conclusion that in all likelihood there was a conspiracy. So you had, everyone talks about the Warren Commission. Well, the Warren Commission at one point, 90% of the American people believe the Warren Commission. Now I think there's only about 70% disagree with it. There's been a complete change. But again, the most, I think, one of the most important government investigations that has received not its full share of coverage was the House Assassination Committee that looked into this for 2 years. They came to a completely different conclusion than did the Warren Commission.
And I would agree with Tom. And I guess the thing that I would be concerned about would be that if you uncover evidence that there is some conspiracy, whatever it was between whom and whom, then it could lead to people concluding that the government's lying. And, well, what else are they lying about? What other things are we not being told?
Well, I think the bigger question, Tom, I would ask you, and I'll get reaction from the guests as well, and that is let's put ourselves back into the Oval Office with President Johnson looking at all of the information that is coming before him before the Warren Commission made its report. The Warren Commission didn't come out until late 1964. He appointed the Warren Commission. I think he appointed people that really didn't want to know the answer. In 1964, they were held in high esteem. People of those positions are not held in the same esteem today than they were 50 years ago. But it seems to me that part of the evidence that was coming to the President of the United States was the possibility that Fidel Castro was involved in the assassination, that maybe the Soviet Union was involved in the assassination, that maybe there was some sort of access between the Soviet Union and Cuba. Now, if that was the evidence that was coming before the President of the United States, in that climate, I don't know how the American people would have done anything but demand that there be U.S. military action against Cuba or the Soviet Union, just as we had that same reaction when 9/11 hit. We had to have the American people demanded that someone had to pay for it. And I think the evidence at that particular point, in a lot of cases, and by the way, it feeds a lot of the conspiracy that came, you know, today's the 50th anniversary, as I said, of when the conspiracies began. Right. But the point is, in retrospect, maybe the President of the United States acted responsibly by, frankly, quashing that information because he didn't believe it was in the United States' best interest to go into to have a military action against Cuba or the Soviet Union, fearing that maybe the United States might lose a war with the Soviet Union. I mean, things were pretty close.
Or you'd get back to nuclear exchanges.
Or you'd get back to
exchanges. I want to say, to answer Tom's question, I agree. I think that the government files should be released. And I'm going to throw in one other. Jacqueline Kennedy spoke to Arthur Schlesinger Jr. on tape shortly after the assassination. I mean, I think it was 6 months after the assassination. This is not what she did with William Manchester. This is something different. Those conversations were released already. The Schlesinger conversations are not going to be released until, I think, 2107 or something like that. And I think that all of this information should come out.
You know, I agree with you, Bruce, as well, that it may have been in the best interest for Johnson to seal those because of the sensitivity, because of that. There was obviously sentiment there. My question is, why 87 years? Why not a more reasonable time? To me, that something's in those documents that
right.
they felt like needed to be sealed for a lot longer than just a reasonable period. And that's where I have a little bit of issue of what's in there. Right. I think
it also I think it might also explain, obviously, Lyndon Johnson's presidency and his great success congressionally with civil rights and the war on poverty and the Great Society. I mean, that was diminished in the eyes of many Americans and in world leaders because of his conduct of the war in Vietnam. And I'm wondering if that war in Vietnam and the aggressive way in which President Johnson began to fight that war, I wonder whether that in the back of his mind was, you know what, he saw the link between the Soviet Union and Vietnam, and he realized that he couldn't go after the Soviets, he couldn't go after the Cubans because of the evidence that he believed he had, but he decided that he had to flex his military might and basically the retaliation against those that were enemies of John Kennedy, he really took out in the way in which he conducted the war in Vietnam.
Yeah, could very well be.
I agree.
Too far-fetched?
No, I mean, actually, it's all making sense, and it's actually much less conspiratorial than the conspiracy theories, the far-whacked-out conspiracy theories would suggest. You know, I think there is
the far-out-whacked ones? I want to know.
Well, you know, that
a reasonable.
Well, I think the most far-out are those.
Johnson was involved.
That Johnson was involved in that he used elements of CIA, FBI, and the Dallas Police Force to physically get this thing done. Yeah. I think that is probably today that would be considered the farthest out.
I agree
and
with
preposterous
that.
Preposterous, too. And I would add that you know, it really is in the national interest of the United States of America not to have a nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union, right? It would make sense that some sort of, like, you know, prudence, some prudence would take over, right? I mean, if the American people find out that their president was assassinated, a very popular young Camelot leader was assassinated by factions of the Soviet Union, then there might be a dictate to act in the most forceful of ways, and that is a nuclear exchange, which is something that Kennedy lived and literally died trying to move away from.
But what the American people didn't know at that particular time, pre-Warren Commission, they did not know the extent to which the United States government, the Attorney General, the Kennedy administration was attempting to destabilize Cuba, to assassinate Fidel Castro,
that's true. Right.
Utilizing elements of organized crime and the CIA, all of the dirty laundry that came out during the Church Committee investigations. Not the assassination house, that was later. It's two different investigations.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But the Church Committee investigations, really, it presented to the United States citizens and to the world and at the darker side of the Kennedy administration that they were doing.
Which, in fairness, was the darker side of the Eisenhower administration and then became the darker side of the Johnson and the Nixon and the Ford and the Carter.
Inherited.
And by Carter, I mean, by Carter, that Carter is essentially when the church thing happened and things began to change then. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, I think that there was a vast amount of ignorance about Kennedy personally, about Kennedy's health, about the international situation, about things. You know, they had resolved the Cuban Missile Crisis with a pledge not to take military action against Cuba. But the Kennedys found their way into trying to hire Murder, Inc. to go get rid of Castro.
The reaction that many had, media as well as certainly Republican leadership. And look at the reaction to Monica Lewinsky with Bill Clinton in the White House, and the way the American people reacted to that in a negative way, we went through the impeachment, we went through all of that. When you compare the national security implications of what Bill Clinton did, and you compare that with the national security implications of what John Kennedy was doing with a girlfriend of a mob leader in Chicago, the opportunity for blackmail and violation of national security interests was 10 times more important for in the Kennedy case than it was in the Bill Clinton case.
You had the underage girl from Miss Porter's who was brought in. I mean, she wrote that's all out. I mean, she wrote her book. I mean, Kennedy was a war. I mean, and that's one of the ways he first came to the attention of J. Edgar Hoover when he was a young congressman. He had I want to say when he was a young congressman, he had a girlfriend who was that the German journalist. Right. And there was great concern about her loyalties, and he was deeply involved with her. He was single at the time, but she was a real big girlfriend. Astrid, what was her name? I forget. Anyway, that Hoover was absolutely panicked about that.
Well, on that note, we are going to pause 1-800-723-8290. We are going to switch gears, I promise. If you want to talk about this subject, we'll take your calls. But again, we're going to switch gears, talk about some other things when we come back on this, the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination conspiracy theory. Again, it started when Jack Ruby shot and killed Lee Harvey Oswald live on television 50 years ago this morning. Come on back in Chicago. Let's introduce the folks around the round table. And by the way, if you're listening to this program on radio, which everyone is right at this moment, because this version of our program is not on television, we really do this program from a round table. You know, all the Washington shows that say that we're going to go to our round table next, the tables are never round. They're not. They're oblong. They're square, whatever it is. When you listen to Beyond the Beltway and we talk about the round table, our table is really round.
Mm. It is.
And around this round table tonight, we have Philip Beverly. Philip, tell everyone who you are and what inspires you in life.
Oh, wow.
Well, you can forget the second part because we've only got a half hour left.
I'm an associate professor of political science at Chicago State University. I've been there since the fall semester of 1991, so that gives me a bit more than 22 years there. Quickly, the thing that inspires me is really my students and just being in a classroom with them and just trying to drag the cynicism of politics out of them.
Hmm. Nick Katchrubas.
Nick Katchrubas, visiting assistant professor at DePaul University in our School of Public Service. I've been there. This is my second year. And I also am a city clerk of the city of Crystal Lake. And I am inspired by leadership and leadership development and helping other people to learn how to be good leaders in today's society.
Chris Roebling.
Hi, I'm Chris Roebling, and I'm a Republican activist, even in the state of Illinois. I don't know. What short straw did I get?
You're a masochist.
You know? You're the one.
Yeah, what the heck?
You're not a bomb thrower. You're not a bomb thrower. You're a brief thrower.
I'm an activist, yeah. And I'm inspired, I know this sounds corny, but by my wife and kids.
Very good. Khalil Morar.
Thank you. My name is Khalil Morar. I am assistant professor at Governor State University. I'm inspired by the generosity of the American people. I hate to sound self-serving, but we really are some of the finest people on earth.
Where are you from?
I'm from Kuwait. I was born in Kuwait and moved to this country in 1987.
And you're a citizen since?
Since 2000 and, I should know this, 2003 and 2004. Yeah.
Okay.
Very
good.
Something like that.
We are now going to give each – we're going to ask each guest, or hopefully we'll ask each guest – To lay on the table a topic that is near and dear to your heart that you think is not covered well by the media. Start with you, Nick.
Well, Bruce, as you know, my research that I recently did was looking at the relationship between the President of the United States and his chief and deputy chief of staff. And I looked at Clinton and Bush and interviewed their chiefs and deputy chiefs. But one of the things that I have been contemplating as I've watched, and I know you hate to go back to the Obamacare issue, but in terms of tenure of chief of staff, one of the questions I struggled with Bush had two chiefs of staff. Clinton went through four. As we look at Obama particularly, one of the factors that I saw that was key in both administrations, Republican or Democrat, was this relational ability of working with Congress and working with the cabinet and working with national security advisors to roll out plans and to get everything working together so that way it's almost seamless in working in a presidential administration. Obama has gone through – on paper he says four, but it's actually been five because he had an acting chief of staff. He's gone through more chiefs of staff in any modern presidency that we've seen. And I just wonder how that plays, and get some comment from the other folks onto how this president has been able to, one, work or not work with Congress, and two, the rollout of his signature initiative.
I want to let Philip respond to that, because Philip, for those who are not longtime listeners to this program, you are an African-American college professor, left of center from Chicago, and yet in the primary, you were not a supporter of Barack Obama.
No.
Some of these same reservations that Nick just referenced. I remember you laying those on the table long ago.
Yeah, I was concerned about his executive experience and decision-making, because being an organizer, which is great, being a law professor, great, I get all that. That's much more collaborative and almost collegial. Where's the decision maker, the single buck stops here guy? And I didn't think that he had that experience, and I was concerned about that.
Chris Roebling, what are the important issues that you think need more coverage than the media allows?
This may sound ethereal, bureaucracy. Bureaucracy is, in many respects, in my opinion, the top story of the 20th century. And I think that technology can overcome bureaucracy, which is a 4,000-year-old story. I mean, if you go back to the Chinese Water Department, I mean, to become one of the top chiefs in China, you had to deal with the Chinese water bureaucrats. Yeah. And the same was true in Egypt. I mean, so water led to an engineering class, which essentially took on almost Mandarin-like status, not to use a word, but that's and today we see bureaucracy trundling on in things like Obamacare. And we see one of the vast disasters of bureaucracy. Even if you are the biggest supporter of Obamacare, you've got to look at what's happened over the last 45 days, you know, reduced to tears. That your big program, the big success that you were going to have, they gave this website to a bureaucracy, and they couldn't even come up. Then you hit the story about those three smart guys in San Francisco, and they're down in the Tenderloin District, and they've got their little storefront, and they walk in there on a Friday, and by Monday at noon, they've got a working website. I mean, you know, this, it's just so classic. And I think liberals, and I used to be one, I was raised one, I was a Kennedy Democrat, you know, as a kid, the liberals really ought, if they were against bureaucracy, I think they would get a lot more resonance. And I think if Republicans, when they got into power, if they would take action against bureaucracy and overcome it with technology, I think they would get a lot more resonance.
Khalil Morar, do you agree with that?
You know, when I first heard
and
the
how
word,
do you start it? How do you start?
I teach bureaucracy as a political science professor, but when I first heard the word bureaucracy, I'm like, yuck! But this is the best explanation of bureaucracy I've ever heard, and actually the best analysis I've ever heard. Because the truth is,
would you expect? Would you expect anything less?
Not from Mr.
Beyond the Rolling.
No, I got this from Oliver Williamson, Professor Williamson out at Berkeley. I luckily got to study under him.
And you know, I think what I'm really passionate about is. We should, as the, you know, sort of the generous people that we are, give people the benefit of the doubt. You know, and I'm seeing this administration being butchered in public opinion polling and in sort of like, you know, the media turning against Obama as if the media was, you know, basically in the tank for Obama in the first place.
Well, they were.
Well, we have to be careful with that. I mean, the media has a love affair with every American president. American president during the honeymoon period. Now, maybe President Obama had a longer honeymoon, but he was just so damn romantic. I mean, he was much more charming than the average American president to begin with. But here's really what I want to get back to. I want to get back to this.
And that's objective. You're speaking objectively now.
Very objective.
Not historically.
Look. Here's what we have to get back to. We have to get back to the notion that we have to respect the office, right? And
we have
to respect the profession. And I'm not just talking about the presidency. I'm talking about, you know, we've lost faith in so many enterprises, right? Whether it's, you know, the professors or the leaders in Congress, and I'm not saying Congress doesn't deserve it. Don't get me wrong. I mean, they deserve their 9%, every ounce of their 9% approval rating. What I'm saying is this. What I'm saying is we need to get back to a time where
where really to be American is a privilege and an honor that, that is bestowed on you, and that is also something that you earned, right? I mean, I'm reminded of Kennedy's words of ask not, right? The ask not moment is something that I think we've lost, right? Not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country.
Where did we lose it, Nick, in your
maybe
view?
It is 60s.
Where do you think? I mean, we lost it a long time ago.
I think, you know, again, based on my research, I think the advent of the modern 24-hour media has placed, they have to feed this beast. And so the pressures under an administration, you can't say something and then actually think about it and change your mind later, which is a detriment because it's going to be played on CNN or C-SPAN or one of these channels 100 times after it because you actually took time to get facts. And
so media pressure forces politicians to make bad decisions.
Well, make hasty decisions.
It makes them forced to comment on something when they haven't had a chance to decipher through a thing. Because if something's
reported, do you have an example of anybody have an example of where they think that happened?
Oh,
I do. If you don't,
no, go ahead.
I do. I think that one area where media pressure forced a bad decision was at Waco.
I think that the
drumbeat day in, day out, that this small compound was being held and you had the power of the United States government surrounding it was growing and growing and growing. And it, because of that pressure early in the administration of Bill Clinton and early in the administration of Janet Reno, I think they made a bad decision. Which led to the raid on Waco, which only exacerbated the loss of confidence that many people have in the government to act wisely.
I would also add our reactions to 9/11.
Well, I would add Romney, the Romney campaign initial round of comment on Benghazi.
Interesting.
Initial comment. They knew something was wrong. But I don't believe they knew enough of what was wrong, and they didn't chart it out correctly, and they ended up looking bad.
Right. You know, I'm also inclined, as a political science professor, I'm also inclined to study causality, like what causes what, right? So why did President Obama fire so many chiefs of staff, right? I mean, is it that there's a Congress that's very obdurate, very hard-headed, refuses to work with him, right? And that causes President Obama to be look like he was finicky, right? Or is it the reverse, right?
I got two words.
That's why we don't have
I got two words.
He's got two words. He's here, got two words.
Valerie Jarrett. There is no president has had a Valerie Jarrett, and that's why no president has the record that Nick was talking about. Valerie is very unique.
You know what really stinks also about media is that we tend to personalize, like one person is the cause of this or that.
In many cases, they are.
No, I don't think so. I think it's much more complicated than that.
Well, not in this case.
I think in some cases.
Most Americans wouldn't even know who Valerie Jarrett is.
As political science professors, we don't see it in very simplistic terms.
We don't. That's right.
Because there's other explanations that have to be ruled out.
Absolutely.
That if you don't have some sort of reflection, you're not going to get to.
Okay.
The simple explanation.
I'm here, and I'm just waiting for you to get here.
Secretary Sebelius? Isn't she? Anyway, back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, and during that segment, there was something else that you got very exercised about.
Just Chris about Robin. Martin Bashir, MSNBC, and, you know, where are we going to draw the line about civil discourse? And what he said about Sarah Palin, long story, but you look it up on the internet, it was so horrible that he himself personally, the next time he was on the air, apologized. MSNBC has continued to promote the segment in which he made the remarks for which he has apologized, and MSNBC, which suspended Alec Baldwin for at least 2 weeks and maybe for the rest of his contract because of a possibly offensive comment that he made to some person on the street in New York City,
a reporter, yeah,
chose not to discipline in any visible way Martin Bashir for what he said about Sarah Palin, which he himself subsequently apologized for. I think that's rank hypocrisy. I think that's a double standard. I think that if conservatives are offended, that's too bad for them. They're lucky to get the apology from Bashir.
In your view, Chris, because you're the card-carrying Republican, I want to get your reaction. Sarah Palin was on television today. She was on for about 20 minutes. Is her political star totally gone?
Oh, I don't think so.
Did she make a comeback?
Well, I think, for instance, Sarah Palin could win a Senate nomination in a multi-candidate Republican primary in a state like Arizona, should she choose to do that someday. She could probably, I think at this point, she would win in Alaska, and I think that she would come back. I think that Sarah Palin has a certain charm and attractiveness all of her own, obviously, because she goes around and so many thousands of people turn out to hear her. But most importantly, I think that Sarah Palin represents a segment of the electorate. And just as I respect, you know, Bobby Rush or Lindsey Graham because they represent segments of the electorate, you see a Sarah Palin and you say, that's part of the American tapestry. And I'm not one to go up and pull one strain out. I mean, I like Sarah Palin, and I think she says a lot of good things.
And I would be more concerned whether she'd finish a term or not.
She does make a lot more money being out of office.
Absolutely. Yep. And there's less responsibility.
Absolutely.
I think her power is in the fact that she does motivate a base. She's a bully pulpit. People follow her. You may or may not like her.
She's a populist.
But I don't think that matters to her. Is she can motivate people. And like Chris said, in the right environment, I think she can get elected.
Do you think that she should or would run for president in 2016?
I don't think she should run for president. Would I don't think she's probably going to do that either. I think she,
if she did, she's Chris Roebling. Look. The landscape is pretty littered with Republican candidates.
I think that her answer about president in 2012 would be her answer probably in 2016, probably in 2020. Who knows where she ends up? I think it's far more likely that she'll end up in the Senate. Mm-hmm. And I don't think one of the things that I think people find appealing, she doesn't burn to be in office.
Right.
I think she is a proponent of ideas.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, some people denigrate her or her ideas. That's up to them. But that's who she thinks she is. And I think that's where she'll be for a while.
She's a populist, and she has a lot more impact from the sidelines criticizing government than being in government. Mm-hmm.
She's a Republican activist.
She is. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So she's just like Newt Gingrich.
Yes.
No, I think she's got a lot more currency than Newt Gingrich.
But I think
Gingrich is a public servant. I don't think Sarah Palin is a public servant per se. She really is more of an activist. She taps into a populist mood in the same way that, say, like a Reverend Jesse Jackson would tap into a populist mood, given his base, right?
But she was a public servant. I lived in Alaska, and I can tell you the fact that she took on the oil lobby.
Yeah.
No one down here, none of the liberals, none of the independents, none of the reformers ever gave her – none of them ever really understood what that meant.
Yeah.
And what she did up there on a political courage scale is a 9.9.
And I would go back to the point of what I was trying to make earlier about the media. You know, we criticize her a lot, and we make fun of her, the media does, but, you know, that – being in that spotlight of a national election, now we can argue whether McCain's choice of her was a good choice or not, but that's a lot of pressure. And I think she's learned a lot, and she should be given a little bit of she's grown in that, and she knows her base, and she's moving forward.
But she's still also very gaffe prone, right? And in the media fixated on gaffes, right? She's like, you know, left of Joe Biden, if left is gaffe prone.
Oh, I don't know.
I don't know.
So is Joe Biden, does he not have a future?
Uncle Joe definitely has a future. I just don't think it says anything that, you know, involves anything that's worthwhile. I think he'll go down history as a very ineffective vice president, right? Next to a very effective president. I think President Obama will go down as one of the most effective, efficacious presidents in history.
Oh,
we have to wait for the historians to give us some separation from this presidency.
Mark my words, then.
And I would say historians. The same thing about George W. Bush. We need to give ourselves some separation from that 8-year period in our history before we continue to criticize how bad it was. And my historian friends who are trained in this say, you guys are always looking for the immediate answer. You need to take a step back. And that's very true. And I think we won't know about this president for another 20 years.
Dr. Beverly, I'm a political scientist but a historian at heart, and I will tell you that both Bush and Obama will go down as the most effective, quote-unquote, presidents. Now, again, love or hate their policies, that's a different thing. I think this period after 9/11, I think not after 9/11, that really did change the trajectory of the nation, for better or worse.
And the quality of the institution. I mean, what we didn't talk about the filibuster. We didn't talk about the filibuster this week, but it is obvious that Obama has operated on a unitary executive theory.
And Bush.
Bush, too.
And Bush,
The Democrats attacked Bush for doing it. Now
so
they're
we
happy.
Expect the Republicans
now
to
they are happy that Obama is doing it.
Except that Obama's not getting anything done. He's not getting his way at all in Congress. He's gotten nothing passed.
Well, then, how is he going to be a great leader?
That's the question I have.
No. Next time, Khalil's on.
Out of time. No. Go back to your corners. Go what? Go back to the corner of your table, the round table. Our thanks to Philip Everly from Chicago State, Nick Katcharubas from DePaul University, Khalil Mirar of Governor State, and Chris Roebling of Jane C. Thompson University and Associates. I'm Bruce Dumont. This is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. Our thanks to Tom Vera-Cruz and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.